beetles that turn 100-year-old trees into dead gray sticks are ripping through forests in western Canada. Many experts say the infestations are caused by warmer weather linked to global climate change. And that's not all. According to a new study, these beetle outbreaks could also end up making global warming worse. NPR's John Nielsen has the story.
When the thick green forests that cover much of British Columbia turn red in the spring, it usually means the end is near. Werner Kurtz of the Canadian Forest Service says that's because the redness is a sure sign that these forests have been overrun by tiny black pine beetles that carry a deadly fungus.
And within a few months, the foliage falls off. And so you basically go from a sea of green to a sea of red to a sea of gray over very large areas.
Pine beetles are nothing new in Canada, but Kurt says they've never been as active or as destructive as they are right now. Since 1997, he says they've killed at least 30 million acres worth of jack and lodgepole pine trees. That's an area the size of Pennsylvania.
This current outbreak is at least one order of magnitude greater than anything recorded in history. And we think that it is, for a variety of reasons, probably the largest outbreak that has ever occurred.
Kurt says this gigantic infestation is destroying logging towns and driving tourists away. And there's another problem. If the beetles keep on spreading, they could ruin Canada's plans to slash emissions of carbon dioxide, the most important global warming gas. Kurtz says it's easy to understand that particular connection if you remember that live trees suck lots of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That means Canada's giant forests can take up staggering amounts of CO2, but only while they're alive.
And if these forests get disturbed, then trees are killed. And as the tree decomposes, carbon dioxide is released back into the atmosphere.
Recently, Kurtz led a team that tried to figure out how many trees those beetles would end up killing in the end and how much CO2 the dead trees would release. In the current issue of the journal Nature, he says computer models showed that the infestations would be over by the year 2020 at the latest. But by then, the rotting trees will have released 270 megatons of carbon dioxide. Kurtz says that is disturbing. First of all, it just so happens that 270 megatons is exactly the amount of greenhouse gas that Canada had planned to cut by the year 2012, which means that the beetles have just made that task much harder. Secondly, it means that Canada's forests are about to become a source of carbon dioxide and not a place where it gets stored away. Basically, says Kurtz, it's a double whammy.
The warming is enhancing the beetle, and the beetle in turn, through its impact on the greenhouse gas balance of the forests, is enhancing the warming.
This is one of the first attempts to understand how insects might make global warming worse. And ecologist Jeff Hickey of the University of Idaho says he hopes it won't be the last. Hickey says this study makes him wonder whether other insect infestations are compounding global warming problems as well.
In eastern Canada, there's extensive outbreaks of spruce budworm. In boreal Russia, there's outbreaks of a moth that appear to kill many trees. So this is not a unique situation in a global sense, and therefore the global models need to account for this kind of biotic disturbance.
Especially in countries that are counting on their forests to suck a lot of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
This week, in honor of Earth Day, we've been looking at the environmental footprint of food.
Award-winning writer Michael Pollan has covered the food industry for years. In his most recent work, In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto, he offers practical advice for people who want to keep themselves and the planet healthy.
And that involves some tricky choices, especially in today's world, where 17,000 new food products are introduced to shoppers every year. Day-to-Day's Alex Cohen has more.
Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. That's Michael Pollan's food philosophy in a nutshell. And as Pollan took me through the garden in front of his Berkeley home, he offered another piece of advice: grow your own food.
We've got peas, chard, beets, broccoli over there, some cabbage. There's some radicchio down there. And catnip. I have one crop for my cat.
Gardening has a very low carbon footprint and the added benefit of helping you stay in shape. And Pollan says it's cheap.
This is a tremendous bargain. A pack of seeds cost a buck or two and can produce $30, $40 worth of food. It is a free lunch. There still is a free lunch.
For the items you can't grow in your garden, Pollen recommends shopping at the local farmer's market. That's where he picked up a dozen eggs from chickens raised on grassy pastures instead of at a factory.
And you can tell the difference as soon as you crack them open. They're bright orange, they're full of beta carotene, and they stand up really tall in the pan. They have what farmers call muscle tone. They're not cheap. I just spent $7 for a dozen eggs, which to some people will seem an outrage.
Many people can't afford things like grass-fed beef and local produce, especially now with the weak economy and food costs on the rise. That's why Michael Pollan says we need to think about food as something more than just stuff we eat.
It's a vote. It's not just buying something that's going to taste good. It's a vote for a certain kind of landscape, a certain kind of agriculture, a certain kind of community. So that's how I justify to myself what is, you know, a lot of money to spend.
Of course, casting that vote may be easier for Michael Pollan, living in a town that has three farmers markets a week year-round. Many Americans don't have that kind of access and are left to shop at traditional grocery stores.
There's plenty of good food in a supermarket. There's a way to navigate the supermarket where you'll end up with some decent food.
But it can be tricky to make healthy, earth-friendly choices in bigger stores. Best to shop on the fringes of the supermarket, Pollan says. Stay away from the middle aisles, where you'll find processed food in packages with labels like trans fat free, low cholesterol, heart healthy. Labels, Pollan says, that food companies have paid a lot of money to use.
You've got these vegetables, very, very healthy, sitting there silent as stroke victims, while at two aisles over, the Cocoa Puffs are boasting about their whole grain goodness and heart healthiness. I mean, this is an absurd situation. The healthy food is quiet. So buy the quiet foods in the market.
Michael Pollan has other rules. Don't buy products with more than five ingredients or any ingredients you can't easily pronounce, which is why I was slightly surprised when I peeked into his fridge.
And I happen to notice there's a Best Foods real mayonnaise. There's a couple of things in here that maybe aren't straight from the farm.
Well,
how do you make your choices?
I'm not a fanatic. You'll also find there's, packaged, spray whipped cream. See here? Sweetened, ultra-pasteurized, whipped light cream. And this is, this breaks many of my rules. It has more than five ingredients. And this is something my son loves to have on waffles on the weekends.
And this is perhaps the most important point about food choices that Pollan makes. Don't freak out about it.
If you get this vote right, a couple times a day, if you buy $20 worth of local food a week, not all, you're making a huge contribution. But the idea you're going to get it right every single meal, every single purchase, is just not realistic.
When there's too much pressure to make only right choices, he says, consumers often get frustrated and end up not making any good choices. And that, he says, is the worst decision of all. Alex Cohen, NPR News.
And for more on Michael Pollan's philosophy on food, you can go to our website, npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, on this 39th Earth Day, an example of green building, specifically a house in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood of Washington, D.C. It was built in the late 19th century, and now it has been rehabbed with a 21st century eye on the environment.
Hi, I'm Amy Levin.
Levin is a real estate agent. She bought this three-story house, and then she had it gutted and rebuilt.
Hi, I'm Peter Yost. I'm with Building Green from Brattleboro, Vermont.
Building Green publishes environmental building news and Green Spec, a guide to residential building materials for people who are concerned about the environmental impact of their homes. Peter Yost flew in from Vermont to see Amy Levin's very rare project, an urban residential gut rehab that's built to meet the LEED Platinum standard. LEED is spelled L-E-E-D, and since LEED is a program of the U.S. GBC, we start with a serving of green alphabet soup.
L-E-E-D stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design.
U.S. GBC, the U.S. Green Building Council, VOC.
That's a good one.
Volatile Organic Compound.
That's what we don't want.
When you make a home a lot more energy efficient, it means you're keeping a lot of the same air inside the house, so it's even more important that you not dump a bunch of chemicals into it. Low VOC or no VOC means that as the material dries or cures, it's giving off a lot less complicated organic molecules into the air.
Okay, let's go inside.
Yeah.
Amy Levin's greenhouse has a decidedly modern but rustic look inside. Exposed brick, open tread stairways to the second and third floors, blonde wood cabinets and stainless steel fixtures in the kitchen. The shelves and moldings are often rough-hewn, and a lot of what she used is recycled, including some of the wood.
So I guess starting in the front here, you know, basically all the flooring is reclaimed, you know, from the original structure. Some of it was moved around, and it's heart pine, so.
So in sort of the hierarchy of things, you've got reuse, first of all.
Yeah.
And then salvage, second.
Yeah, lots of reuse, lots of salvage, and I'll show you kind of when we walk through sort of little places where we did that. But, you know, I mean, building envelope being the biggest thing, the windows are pretty high up on the scale of the various U factors and other things to keep the efficiency levels going. And then behind the walls, there's bio-based spray foam insulation.
A lot of materials being sort of hidden behind the wall, but yeah. You're going to have utility bills that bring that right back from in the forefront from behind those walls.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I got my bill from the other house that I moved out of. My bills here are about half of what they were all winter. You know, I think the focus on the payback is one of those things that I think we really have to be selling people. I mean, social consciousness is super important, but, you know, from a dollars perspective, it's starting to become easier to show people that green pays.
There's a bunch of programs for new homes that actually provide energy bill guarantees.
Yeah.
And I've never heard of it being available on a retrofit, but the concept is pretty powerful because if you can tell people, well, you know, we'll guarantee what your bill's going to be because we have such confidence in the way the house performs. So there's a lot of ways to translate, you know, the hard work that's behind the walls into stuff that really catches people's attention.
Well, Amy, you talked to us about the envelope, about the roof, the walls, the floor. Now more into the interior. Let's
yeah,
move inside.
Yeah, sure,
I want you to
sure.
point out some things to us.
Okay, so all the trim here, all the windowsills, all the trim, and then also the breakfast bar is from the same guy who got me those locust trees out front. His name is Marcus Sims, and he has a company called Tree Incarnation. And he takes all felled trees from Montgomery County, Maryland, and makes furniture and dimensional lumber and things like that. I thought that was pretty cool. It's a local product. So as far as other materials in here, like the drywall is high percent recycled content. All the paints are either no or low VOC. And I tried to, you know, sort of mix and match just being a trial house of, you know, using different types of paints and such. So in here...
here we are in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And
the breakfast bar here is made out of mulberry. It's, again, another felled tree from Montgomery County.
I've never seen a piece of decorative mulberry. I mean, this is amazing. It's a really beautiful piece of wood.
He does amazing work, I think, so... The cabinets, this and the roof, I think I was most excited about as far as something that you can do that's green that can be less expensive than going to order. And it's something that cabinets are not often part of a green process at all, from finishes to materials and all that other stuff. Actually, if you want to open that door right there, you can kind of stick your nose in there and take a whiff. And you can smell the wheat board. So there's wheat board there is what the boxes are made out of, and that's an agro byproduct. And then... the veneer part and the doors and the sides are all made out of Pure Bond, which is Columbia Forest Products.
So this is a composite of some.
It's like a plywood almost.
But the veneer looks like maple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the countertops in the kitchen. What did you go for here?
So this is concrete. Looked at a couple different options, but I just like concrete. I like how it looks. There's a company here locally, a guy named Steve Eiler. His company's called Icon, and he tries to start using now, like, locally recycled aggregate product, too. So I guess there's a dam here nearby where they're taking a bunch of stuff off the back of it, and people are trying to crush it up and reuse it into other concrete stuff. So
has he experimented at all with fly ash content in his concrete?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He does offset as much Portland cement as possible. I think it's, you know, you can go up to 50% now, I guess.
What's fly ash content?
The most environmentally damaging ingredient in concrete is Portland cement. And it's about a third of its content. It's very, very energy intensive to create. And the fuels they use to calcine the material are among the dirtiest fuels that we use. So whenever you can replace fly ash, which is the combustion byproduct of coal combustion, you're taking a waste material and it actually improves the performance of the concrete.
Mm-hmm. It's really cool because it makes it a little bit darker, a little grayer, kind of gives it a little funkier look when you finish it.
Let's go upstairs. We walked up to the roof where Amy has a rack of evacuated tubes for her hot water heater. She and Peter Yost say this is an efficient form of solar energy collection. There's also a tankless gas-heated backup. This is a $500,000 rehab project, and it is green in a variety of ways. Green means solar energy. It means front-loading washer and dryer to cut down on water and energy use. It means double-flush toilets, less water for liquid waste than for solids. It also means using materials that are non-toxic, recycled, and recyclable, materials that conserve energy when they're produced and when they're in service. And Peter Yost says of all these green virtues, the greenest is durability. Install something that lasts a lifetime. That consumes less energy than something that's more efficient in the short run but has to be replaced several times. We're on the porch. I mean, what is the flooring and the railing? What's it all made of?
Yeah, so this is just tracks.
It's a plastic wood fiber composite material, and it sort of takes the best attributes of two very different materials. Plastics tend to contract and expand a lot. Wood rots. Well, if you mix them together, you get a lot less contraction and expansion, and you get a more durable material than the wood. Mm-hmm. And both are generally reclaimed materials that go into the manufacturing process.
I mean, one sign of what green is nowadays is green means easy on energy, durable, efficient, not necessarily natural. I mean, we're talking about lots of synthetic materials that go into making a very green home. I mean, I think 25, on the first Earth Day, I suspect that would have shocked people that the green house of the 21st century would have so much synthetics in it. But that's very much a part of what we're talking about here.
I think there's a real good connection between the name All Things Considered and green building, because All Things Considered is about looking at things from a whole bunch of different angles, and that's exactly what you do with green building. There are some natural materials that are very appropriate for use in 21st century houses, but there's a lot of neat stuff that we've made, particularly as it relates to energy efficiency, that does a better job than Mother Nature does. So that's the key to when you design, when you specify materials, and when you actually build the home, it's All Things Considered. It's taking a look at things from a bunch of different angles and then optimizing what you come up with for a solution.
That's Peter Yost of Building Green and Amy Levin of Washington, D.C. You can see her house and find more on the materials that she used at our website, npr.org. And as Peter Yost would say, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Some news now from Earth Day. A brewery in Vermont announced it was signing up for something that dairy state has plenty of, cow power. A utility in Vermont is offering, for just a few cents more, power derived from the methane gas given off by the manure on dairy farms. The Long Trail Brewery Company will not only be its biggest customer, but the brewery will be giving something back, mash, a byproduct of brewing that can feed the cows. Thinking about Earth Day this week, and we'll continue now with the green theme. Our last word in business is green TV. Starting this June, you'll be able to watch environmentally friendly programming 24 hours a day. Green Planet is Discovery Channel's new eco-lifestyle TV network.
The only problem is if you want to save energy, you can only watch it 2 or 3 hours a day.
That's right. Well, when you're watching, you'll be able to see rock stars in their eco-friendly musical tours, celebrity chefs cooking up organic dishes. There'll be shows about installing solar panels.
Oh, there we go. Okay, yeah. Now we can do it 24 hours a day. Fine, please.
There you go. It's from the sun. The $50 million project aims to cash in on growing interest in environmental issues and the growing marketplace, this is really key, for green products. So if you're looking for ads for hybrid cars and energy-saving light bulbs, stay tuned to TV. Or better yet, stay tuned to Morning Edition from NPR News, the business news. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Commentator Julie Zickafoos lives in rural Ohio in a home surrounded by trees. She and her family like it that way. It's private. But her land is bordered by a neighbor who recently hired loggers to take the trees down on one side of her house. Logging is a fact of life in the heavily forested area where she lives. Big trees are worth a lot of money. Well, recently, the woodcutters came. Julie says it was especially hard to say goodbye to a huge old tulip tree. It sat on her neighbor's land right outside her kitchen window.
We listened as the bulldozers and chainsaws moved closer each day. One by one, the big trees fell. The loggers were taking everything over 18 inches in diameter, leaving the smaller trees to mature. After 3 weeks, there was only one giant left, the tulip tree we called the privacy tree. We called it that because it shielded our house from the road, made it feel like a secret. I knew the logger was saving the biggest tree for last. He couldn't have overlooked it. It was time to say goodbye. I walked out through the snow, meaning to wrap my arms around it, and had to spread them for a goodbye hug. I know I'm a tree hugger. But it's something in this cut-over, degraded forest to find a tulip tree that's 36 inches at breast height. "Can't we ask them not to cut the privacy tree?" asked my daughter Phoebe, her voice plaintive. "Doesn't the logger have a heart?" "Well, no, honey, we can't ask him. A 36-inch tulip tree is worth money, and it's on our neighbor's land, and that, my dear, is that." While she was at school, I did call my neighbor and offer to compensate him for the value of the tree if he'd just leave it standing. It was a reckless act born of a mother's desire to fix what's wrong. I had no idea what it was worth, figuring I'd either be able to meet the price or not. I just wanted to buy it, to leave it standing, so the tanagers and wood thrushes could still perch in it and sing. He turned me down flat. "Nope, I'm going to cut it. If it dies and falls down, I can't get anything for it, and I don't want it lying around on the ground. Trees are a crop just like anything else, and you need to harvest them before they fall down." I suggested that trees might have another value as habitat even after they fell down, and we hung up, agreeing that we saw things differently when it came to trees. 2 days later, my husband and I watched in silence as a chainsaw snarled into its base. The privacy tree trembled, groaned, spun slowly, and smashed down, taking 5 other trees with it. 4 years ago, I watched with dismay as another forest I loved was logged just like this one. I'd drive by every day, watching it get thinner and thinner. The loggers took all the big trees, piling them like Lincoln logs on a flatbed truck, hauling the forest away in a cloud of diesel fumes. I ground my teeth and muttered as I passed. The next spring, underbrush sprang up in the newly opened woods from seeds that had been waiting for decades in the soil for just such conditions. Within 3 years, new, strange bird songs rang through the open stand. Wild turkeys, American redstarts, blue-winged prairie, hooded and Kentucky warblers flocked to the thick young growth that sprang up in the wake of the cutting. I'll park my car where the logging truck once sat and watch jewel-like birds fetching insects and nesting materials in the flickering sun, in the new growth racing toward the sky. For birds like these to survive and thrive, some trees must fall, some sunlight must strike the forest floor. Even as I mourn the privacy tree, I know that my neighbor's is a changed woodland, and not necessarily for the worse.
Commentator Julie Zickefus lives on an 80-acre nature sanctuary. She's the author of Letters from Eden.